To escape from plan A. Dude, I'm discombobulated because it's a morning pod for me and a super early morning pod for Mike. Good morning, sir. Dude, it looks like the sun's just coming up over there, huh?
It just came up, yep.
You're such an early bird now. Like, waking up at 5 a.m.
I had no idea you were early to sleep, early to rise.
Like, this isn't degeneracy. It's like responsible adulthood.
Yeah, it's what happens when you quit drinking.
Yeah,
here I am with my beer.
I see you've got the 10 p.m. beer there.
Yeah, yeah.
I quit drinking, and I can't get up at 6. That's impossible for me.
Yeah, it's really weird, man. Like when I was younger, I would sleep until God knows when. But yeah, now it's just I'm pretty much in bed by 10 to 10:30, something like that, and then I'm up by usually 5.
I guess you're in like a discipline phase, right? Like everything is kind of.
It's more like when you quit drinking, there's just there's no reason to not be healthy. it's just kind of the default, you know, like, if I'm 40 now, so if I eat junk food, I just immediately get fat. So it's,
I gotta watch.
I wonder if I had complete freedom to set my own time, which I guess I do, but, if it was just me and my wife wasn't here, whether I'd kind of migrate slowly over to like your thing. Cause like, I kind of dig it. I kind of dig like the early morning thing now.
Yeah. It's really quiet and you can get all sorts of shit done.
But there's no way I can go to bed as early as you do. Cause my wife goes to bed at like 2 and I got to stay up a little bit. For some reason, I just got to stay up a little bit past my wife and then go to bed.
Oh, cause you're, well, why is she up till 2?
She's just a late. She's weird. She's a late to sleep, early to rise, and she's completely messes me up. But I gotta ignore it, and I've just gotta go power into bed at like 10 or 11.
Yeah, because it's important. You get old. Yeah, have good discipline.
She just doesn't need as much sleep as I do.
Yeah, some people are like that. Yeah.
She'll get away with like 5 hours and be fine.
Yeah, if I get 4 or 5 hours, I'm a total wreck. So same here. I just don't feel normal.
I mean, people like that essentially have like an advantage in life. Like they basically have 20% more life, waking life.
Yeah.
Than you do. So.
And no mercy for anyone else.
Mm.
Yeah, I heard Tiger Woods in an interview one time say that he only sleeps 4 or 5 hours a night, which is kind of wild.
That's freaking wild.
Wow. Weird.
Freaking wild.
Maybe that's why he doesn't have as many. Dude, this is how tired I am. I can't even think of what one of the four big majors. Maybe this is what he's like, you know, he kind of dropped off on the majors. He went from 8 to 5 hours of sleep.
Right.
All right. And Steve's joining. The reason we're doing this early is because it's you're in the future. You're at night, Friday night over there. And
I'm 13 lovely, hours in the future.
Lovely Hong Kong with a very cyberpunk looking balcony and a pretty lift us up again. Like, give us another view of the city skyline there. Where and tell us where we're looking.
People on the field can't see this, but
so we're looking south.
We are looking west right now, kind of southwestish, southwestish.
But is that downtown? Is that like central Hong Kong?
That's the I think it's called the International Commerce Center, that like really tall guy down there.
Yeah. Isn't that central?
No. That's like West Kowloon. Right? So West Kowloon is kind of like the other West Kowloon's where the you can't really see central from here. You can get this angle. So I don't want to drop my MacBook either. No, that's
Hong Kong is surrounded on 3 sides by water, so the water is beyond that, right?
Yeah, the water's beyond that. So like down there where that is, that's West Kowloon Station, which is where the high speed rail is. And there's actually like a lot of buildings and it's a huge transit hub. I would like to move there actually. It's very convenient. And
how you get into mainland?
Yeah. So it's like, we go there a lot and, there's tons of people living there. There's tons of kids there. Right. So it's good for the kids and there's like pretty good facilities and stuff like that. So I do want to kind of check that out. And then central is kind of like on the other side of the river, right? You can't really see it from here. It's kind of blocked by one of the buildings in this complex here. But yeah, then there's just like a lot more of this. Like central is super dense, or the island itself is just super, super dense. I'll be honest, I don't I don't like it that much, just given the sheer density of it.
Yeah, right?
Like some
say,
of those sidewalks are just.
You moved from a more or less suburban kind of house to
basically to Hong Kong,
right? So
to like super squishy.
How has that been?
It's good that we can go to Shenzhen on weekends, because otherwise, I'd lose my mind. Right? Like,
what's so great about going to? You mean just getting out of the house? That kind
of thing? Yeah. Because like we don't have a yard here, right? I guess we could go out and, you know, have a walk or have a hike. There's a couple parks nearby, which is all fine and everything, but it just doesn't have that same kind of like, I don't know. Maybe we're just not used to it yet. We go to Shenzhen because there's just like more space for the kids to run around. It's way less dense and it's fun. There's a lot of good food. It's cheap. There's a lot happening. So, you know, it's nice. It's nice. I think it's like, you know, New Yorkers leave the city on weekends, right? Same idea. I think it's the same idea.
Yeah, I'm recording this, and then right after this, we're going to go leave the city.
Oh, I just choked on my beer. Where are you going?
We're going to go to Sands Point, which is where, like, you know, Great Gatsby took place. You know, we're gonna go walk around. Yeah, it's like mansions and big yards, big lawns and stuff.
You're right.
That's what we do. I mean, you can't just stick around inside the city all the time. You're going to lose your fucking mind. You got to get out.
Yeah, I think so. Like, it's fine Monday to Friday, but you need the weekend decompress.
Out here, people either go to the beach or they go to like north or south, which is more suburban. There's bigger areas to go hiking or whatever.
For me, nothing really beats the accessibility of LA. To like really just whatever sort of environment you're looking for, woods, mountains, desert.
Yeah, it's all within a couple hours.
It's pretty cool.
It's like that West Coast kind of, because you got the mountain range, right? So you got a lot of different, you got the water and the mountains, basically. Right?
Yeah, the snow has been really good lately, too, since the drought is apparently over. So there's been just a ton of snowfall. So there's a lot of outdoor stuff.
The East Coast, the problem with the East Coast is there's really no diversity of landscape. No matter how many hours I go, it's the same.
Yeah, it's the same. It's kind of flat. Right?
It's flat. It's the same sort of like medium sized tree. It's like an oak tree of some sort.
It's just a copy paste of the same tree.
The first time I went to the East Coast, I was kind of surprised at how many trees there were out like immediately outside of the cities. It looks the same.
It's just giant mediocre forest.
And it just gets warmer as you go south. That's basically the
Pretty much. Looks exactly the same.
I know the exact tree you're talking about because it's like the same thing in Ontario, essentially.
Yeah,
and it's just the same. It's
like they like line the highways.
It's not interesting in any way. It's just like a tree.
It's really thick though. It can get really thick.
It can, but it's just yeah.
There's no There's no giant sequoias here in the East Coast.
Yeah, it's uninteresting. Like I think you need elevation changes or like rivers to be like really interesting, right? So preferably both.
It's just very uniform out here in the East Coast. There's no diversity of landscape at all compared to the West Coast. Yeah. But then there's no, you know, we also have earthquakes and hurricanes and shit.
No, but in New York, not really.
Yeah, we had an earthquake recently.
Like a real earthquake really? or like a 4.5 kind of?
Yeah. No, it was like 4. It was in the 4s, I think.
Yeah. That's pretty significant.
Things fell over, man.
Yeah, if you can feel it like in an apartment building, it's pretty serious.
Not for me, but I mean, apparently some people did have, you know, their drinks mildly disturbed and stuff. It was pretty bad.
Oh, no.
Never forget.
Heaven forbid.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. So we didn't do the time zone splits just for nothing. Mm-hmm. We wanted to talk about something very serious, very intense, which is the future of money. And
money.
Yeah. And all of our collective anxieties about
it.
World's changing, you know? Here's the thing. The world is changing. When I was younger, It was always assumed you just put your money in the stock market and it grows by 10% and that's just how it works and it'll just go that way forever. And if things don't work out well, it's a cycle. That means you just sit tight, go through it. Eventually, you'll be back up to the line and you'll be continuing on. And your financial future was more or less secure if you were just patient. And now I think it's getting harder and harder to believe in the old sort of passive wisdom of markets. And I don't know if that's just because we're becoming more less patient, or whether there's some sort of fundamental change to how the markets and money itself works. But things don't look fucking normal, because we have an economy that some say is about to tank. Others say it's already tanking. You're just, you know, they're lying about it. And others say it's actually doing really well. And I don't know what the fuck everyone's going on about. And the markets seem to have no correlation, or maybe even a negative correlation at this point, to the function of the actual real economy. People are confused. I'm confused. We're all sitting on some cash, some more than others, but we have cash that we got to manage. That cash, you know, as you get older, you're like, oh shit, that cash is my life.
Yeah.
And that number is my life to a great extent.
It's your life, and it's also going to have a big impact on how you die in 30, yes. 40 years. Or
true.
Yes.
True. You mean what are the conditions under which you die?
The conditions under, yes. You know, whether you're healthy, whether you're or not healthy. Yeah.
Whether it's 10 years or 30, yeah. Might even affect that, right? So
shit ain't no joke, you know what I mean? But the problem is that the culture around money seems to be becoming a joke. You know, it's
very nihilistic.
It's nihilistic. It's FOMO. It doesn't seem to want to follow any rational pattern that would allow normal people to make smart decisions with their money. You know what I mean? So
yeah, I think I don't know. Like us lot are in that middle zone. Right. Enough to care, but not enough to not care. And not so little that you don't have to care. If you were really rich, you might not be having this conversation. You might be having a different conversation.
Right? It would be more like a fun, hey, what do you think you're going to do? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But you've got a slug of cash for every scenario. And yeah, you're able you have enough cash passports to split it up into different strategies. Different contingencies,
yeah, multiple numbered Swiss bank accounts, whatever, right?
Yeah.
or you
can take different bets. You can take many
bets. Yeah. Or you know, other, you know, you're somebody who has, I mean, if you're just YOLOing because you're never gonna have a house or whatever, yeah. You know, so that's also, you kind of don't have to care. There's this middle ground of, and I'm not like saying, oh, you need crocodile tears or anything like that, but it's if a revolution comes, it's not good.
Yeah, well, I mean, over the past 5 years, I've done a smaller version of that, which is just I've really diversified the amount of different things that I'm involved in terms of investing and real assets. So it's, you know, I feel like I'm doing what I can at my level, which is sort of upper middle class, non-married guy, to spread out my upside and downside risk appropriately.
What does that actually look like, if you don't mind me asking?
So I own my condo, which is not as good, quote unquote, good as owning a single family home. But I own my condo.
Free and clear, you mean?
No. I have a mortgage. I have a 2% mortgage.
Yeah, keep that.
Fucking awesome.
Keep that.
I was tempted to like pay it down significantly, or maybe even pay it off when I sold the company, but I was like, eh.
It's 2%.
At 2.6%.
You can make a spread on that just by sitting on.
Yeah,
just exactly. By sitting in a money market.
Exactly. So I ended up putting. So I refied my mortgage, which is the most important thing from a cash flow perspective, and then. So I have some money in the stock market. I have some money in, crypto in general. I have some money in like just real assets. Like I have a couple of sports cars, and then I have money market mutual funds and T-bills and treasuries and stuff like that. So it's like a pretty wide variety of really high risk and really low risk stuff.
Do you have any like international exposure? like, or like foreign currencies, maybe, you know, commodities. I don't know if that's really non-USD, but like,
no, I would say the only thing that really fits that is Bitcoin. So I have some Bitcoin, and then, I mean, being in the USD, I think is just the same. If you live in the US, it's probably the safest thing for a person that, you know, has, no intention of moving overseas like Steve did. I don't plan on that. And if I do at some point, it's probably going to be the Southeast Asia. And most of those currencies are, I mean, there's like, I'm not going to hold my money in Thai baht or whatever. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I'll see you sense. There. I'll see you there, buddy.
Right. Yeah. Or the Malaysian.
I'd be there before you.
Malaysian ring
it.
You.
Yeah. The
Malaysian
ring it. Like, yeah. Like I
hold
like,
it down for you.
I'm good. I think I'll just chill out in the USD for my US cash needs.
It almost seems to me whether their currency is going to continue to be really following the U.S. dollar or whether it's going to eventually switch over and start following the RMB.
Yeah, the baht has been, after the Asian currency crisis, the baht has been incredibly stable. Like the first time I went to Thailand was 10, 15 years ago, and it was 30 to 1. And I was there 2 years ago, and it was still like 30 to 1. So it's... Mm.
It's a pegged currency, isn't it?
I don't think they technically peg it, but they manage it.
Yeah, it's managed. It's managed. A lot of those countries, like, they were, I mean, the Asian financial crisis was a big shock to them, right? And afterwards, they really, really kind of went, you could say they cleaned up in a way, right?
Yeah.
And they become much, much less dependent on foreign financiers, right? So they wanted to take control of their own destiny to some extent, right? So
yeah, they probably put in capital controls, except
very
the other
yeah
way.
Very prudent like, fiscal
you can't
management
flood this country with money.
Yeah exactly.
But that's I mean, that sounds fairly defensive, because out of that mix, I mean, everything but the equity seems to be pretty conservative.
And then I have like my speculative account where I just
punt around
options.
It's funny. It's funny though. You consider your sports cars assets.
Yeah, well, you got to buy the right ones.
You got to buy the right ones.
You got to buy the right ones. So if you're not a car person, don't even try it, because your taste is going to be way off the mark.
You're saying my 2010 CRV is not appreciating in value. You don't think that's a good score of value?
I mean, it has been for the last couple of years.
That's true. It's fucking true, man.
As long as it's not depreciating, you're doing well.
Actually, sometimes I look at the resale value and I'm like, yo, I got to get myself into more of these CRVs. This is
the
way to go.
So in the sports car market, like the thing is, the newer cars tend to, like the brand new cars that you buy from the dealership are, they tend to track inflation, right? So what that does is it brings up the prices of the entire market, so that the older cars, they hold their nominal value better, because the entire thing is getting lifted, right? Because of the new prices.
You mean just the general sort of tide for all cars?
Yeah. So
your car is included in that general.
Yeah, and then you have prices, the special cars, which will explode in value. But those are generally like art. That's very
so niche. I mean, just give an idea, like what is that, like, I know, okay, so the some 911s, yeah, and that's almost kind of like the, I don't know, like the standard in a way, right? But then what other kinds of cars are you know, would fall under that it's an investment category?
Well, it's
any car that you gotta buy with a paddle.
Yeah, right.
I feel.
Wrong, right? Like you can track the auctions and all the used, like not just the like the Mannheim used car auctions, which is the more run of the mill everyday cars, but you can look at the high end auctions and see what actually people are interested in. And those don't tend to change over time.
So is it like, you know, Ferraris and Lambos and stuff, or is it?
No, it's all sorts of stuff. Like 90s Japanese cars are going up in value.
Oh, really?
And okay. Yeah, so this is the same thing that happened to muscle cars, right, from the 70s, 60s, right. And
70s. How does one go about buying these things? Here's the thing.
You just go buy one.
This sounds fascinating to me, because I like the idea of real assets. It's just the thing with, like, real estate is that right now I'm a little bit worried that, real estate continues to be overpriced relative to its rental generating potential.
Sure.
I think so. Your return on rents are not that great. I think you have limited capital appreciation on the upside, right?
For housing?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Right now, I don't know. I don't know what you think, but I feel like we're not going to have another huge, you know, bull run in housing prices. Because
I mean, I'd say that's mainly dependent on interest rates, like most things.
Yeah, I don't see the mortgage rate coming down significantly. Anytime
I think
soon.
It'll get down to like 5 and then stay there for a very long time.
Yeah, but even at 5, I just don't see there being enough. There just being enough consumer money to drive prices even further up from where they are now, because they haven't really corrected very much, right?
No, just only in certain markets. And
so, I mean, if it had corrected a lot, we'd have some slack, I feel like, to make up. But now I feel like, you know, we're kind of maxed out. Plus, rents are not really going up anymore. And so
they had a big run, though, didn't they?
They did. And that's what I'm saying, is kind of maxed out. And then if you look at, I don't know, I worked this out a little bit, but it's like if you look at the rental income that you can generate in residential rents.
Yeah. Net of all your costs.
You're about just as well off parking it in fucking treasuries.
We're close to like the carrying capacity of people to just pay rent in general.
Exactly. And exactly. I think people
a lot of landlords are like trying to squeeze blood from a stone at this point, I think. But
yeah.
One other thing that has collapsed recently is a lot of Airbnb markets. Like people are just over it.
Yeah. That's going to put some slack back into the market too, isn't it?
It'll put some slack back into the market. And also, I mean, we still haven't, like, the baby boomers are just living longer than anyone thought they would, right?
I know, like, we keep talking about them. I'm like, aren't they
but, like,
I mean, ready to go? Or, you know?
They own all the fucking houses. And they
youngest
all bought
boomers are like 70 now, aren't they? Maybe 60. Maybe 60.
I think 1959 was like the last boomer.
Okay, so like late. So the 65 then. 65.
Yeah, they're just starting to retire.
Yeah, we've been talking about them forever, man.
Yeah, forever. And they own all the good housing. You know, like they own all the nice big or good location houses. So once they start, but the thing is they don't, like, most of them in a previous iteration of like the world, they would have started selling their houses already to fund their retirements, but they're
loaded because of stocks. Yeah.
By the way, as an aside, Mike, your apartment is so well appointed that it looks like a background.
It kind of does. Like you could make a zoom. Actually, you know what? Take a photo.
Like he's got a Noguchi
background
coffee table there. Does that not look like it's part of some pre-render
background? I want to use this as my zoom background.
Yeah, that's a real Noguchi too, by the way. It's got the laser etch on it.
What's a real Noguchi meaning? Like, who makes a real Noguchi?
What is a Noguchi?
It's the designer of that famous coffee table he's got there.
Oh, really?
Triangular, yeah. So it's all tempered glass.
We gotta start calling you Fancy Mike.
Oh, Mike is fancy, dude. We're Mike talking about his car collection.
That's true.
Not Hot Wheels, man. Like actual fucking cars.
Sports cars.
Yeah.
His fancy designer condo and designer furniture.
Yeah. It's nice.
I mean, this is basically what 10 years of busting your ass looks like.
Which direction do you face? What are we looking? South?
That's south. Yeah, that's south. Okay. So I can see the sunrise and all that.
Very nice. Very nice.
But it's just a thing where, like, I recently did a full sort of inventory of all my assets, and I realized I basically have nothing but cash.
Don't you have like a tax advantage retirement account and all that stuff?
Yeah, but it's not allocated. A while ago, I a lot of that stuff I de-risked. I did a complete de-risking because I'm a panicky dude. I'm much more. Here's the thing, man. Because I don't know how you guys feel, but I'm not a lover of work. Okay. I don't mind working. I like having a job, but I'd rather not have a job if I didn't have to. I guess I don't have to, but like, why not? You know, like, if, because I feel like the number of earning years right now is significantly decreasing.
Yeah. You might as well grind it out for a little bit.
You want to front load it. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. There's still low hanging fruit, right? So I'm going to keep picking that or whatever.
Yeah.
But, here's the thing, when you're work averse and also work, pessimistic like me, meaning like,
what do you mean work pessimistic?
Meaning like, I don't think that there's unlimited earning potential going forward. You know, I think there's significant downside to my field.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
AI is going to kill it. You know what I mean? Like we're not real. Like a lot of us lawyers aren't really thinking about this, but when they start adopting AI as a tool, like a bona fide adoption of AI as a tool, especially on the client side, there's going to be layoffs in the field. Billables are going to drop because like you're already in an environment where corporates are not exactly excited about paying their legal bills. Mm. Like when it's boom time, they don't give a shit. You know, everyone's going out and going to fancy steak dinners and going, haha, thanks for the big bill. And everyone's happy to spread the wealth around. But these days they don't want to pay. And if they can, you know, if the AI tools come, I think it's going to cap a lot of the industry.
But you don't think lawyers have effectively like some kind of almost quasi privileged position? And
they do, but it's not impenetrable. It's not. I mean, and they've been abusing the shit out of that up to now.
Sure,
anyway.
But just like charge more, less hours.
It's the senior partners that will implement all this stuff to get rid of the dead weight and the overpaid.
It could be. I personally think it's actually going to happen on the client side, where they're going to have because the law firms are too general. Like they're seeing too many different things, whereas the clients are very specific. And I think you're going to have very tailored AI legal applications where the clients are going to say, let's have an AI tool do a lot of the early lifting and then we'll have it checked by our GC or we'll have it checked by outside counsel. But
you still need that GC to do the checking.
But there's going to be a lot less need.
Right. But then why wouldn't that result in just like higher billable per hour? Right, because it's like, look, you need me to check this. I'm going to charge you $100,000, no matter what.
Competition. It's still a free market.
I mean, well, yeah, but that's no different from today, right? Like,
well, I'm just saying that a lot of the grunt work that they get to field out to inexperienced lawyers is going to get taken over by AI.
Eventually, it'll be two sides, both with their own machine outputs being checked by a small cadre of humans.
Yeah.
I mean, I hear you on that. I just think like, I wouldn't be totally surprised if the legal industry just had some kind of pricing power at this level, right? Like, you're just going to keep, no matter how much work.
I'm just saying that the number of lawyers is going to decrease.
Yeah, it'll.
The ones that remain, they're going to downsize to the point where their lifestyles remain intact. So, yeah, the lawyers that remain are going to do fine. But the size of the.
Population, it'll
probably track how manufacturing has evolved in the US over the past 30-40 years, right? Like the stuff that remains in the US is very high end and very either protected by unions or is just at the cutting edge of technology.
Mm-hmm.
So the overall like number of people employed in manufacturing has gone down, but the high value stuff remains.
So I agree with that. But then if you take that into law, like, is it kind of like real estate lawyer doing just like churning out stuff, right? Or that kind of sort of, I don't know, call it retail law.
I mean, I would just say that the more boilerplate your work is, the higher at risk you are of being replaced.
Plus, there's going to be entrepreneuring lawyers who leverage AI to amplify the number of clients they can take on, and they're going to give you a better price and they're going to give you good service.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, like, it's
lawyers
it's
are not immune from competition. It's a very competitive field.
it's going to be like CNC machining, right? Like back when you had to operate a lathe and a mill by hand.
This is terrifying lawyers. Can you imagine?
You could, yeah,
telling
you can,
lawyers you can, like, guys, you're going to track the American manufacturing sector. Oh shit.
Oh my God. Shit. What am I going to do?
You know, computer programmers are facing the same thing too, you know, like tech in general. So it's the people who can like see where this is headed and adopt or create the tools that will get you there. That will be big winners, which is
to make a short story long. I think we were talking about this because I was trying to say I'm work averse. I mean, I'm work pessimistic about the future. So I feel like these are some of our last remaining days or years, months, who knows, of I think an old paradigm. And the new paradigm is going to come and it's going to be tougher. I do think that there's going to be a significant downside due to AI, especially in our economy, you know, like an unreal economy that is ripe for AI takeover. Whereas if like we had real jobs that required, you know,
work,
human dexterity or, you know, whatever it is.
Well, even the dexterity, like, I don't know, like if you think, could surgeons be replaced by robots?
No, I don't think. I mean, I think that's going to be the last thing to get. You know, I'm not getting operated on by a fucking AI. I want a human, you know?
Well, it'll help in the.
One surgeon could just kind of do more or something like that. I mean, who knows, right? But, I mean, I share your pessimism.
I'm saying, look, I think that having AIs are now these abstracted intelligences. I don't think we're exactly in the field of like precision robotic fucking surgeries yet, are we? I mean, maybe we are, but I feel like the first thing to go is just going to be like people who play around with words all day.
Yeah, I mean, that's for sure. I mean, AI will definitely augment a surgeon's abilities in the OR. Like, you know, they can help minimize mistakes and use augmented reality to like overlay some fucking anatomical diagram on whatever the thing is he's poking at. But yeah, I think it'll be a very, very long time before a robot actually performs the surgery on your leg or whatever.
Yeah. But anyway, the point being that I don't know if you guys share this, so maybe that's a question to you guys, but because of that, I'm much more sensitive to downside risk on my money than I am to the phone. Also, because I'm old. And as well as I look at my cash position and I'm like, okay, I'm pretty happy with my cash position in a way. Like I'm not desperate to apply a multiple to it. I'm like, okay, look, if I can preserve this, I'm fine. Yeah, I mean, this fits. This will allow me to live my lifestyle.
Like you've got enough to run out the string.
I've got it. Like you said, dude. In the beginning, it's like I've got enough to worry about preserving it.
Yeah.
If I had a lot less, and I'm like, man, dude, fuck it, I'm gonna be broke at some point anyway in the immediate future.
So you must.
I might as well go YOLO into the market, and in a way, that's to people's favor because this is a good YOLO market, right?
It really is.
But I can't YOLO that shit because I'm so terrified of the downside risk. Whereas if I only had a few $1,000 to my name, it would be like, really, I don't give a shit. I can YOLO it because if I lose it, fuck it. I'll just go back to work and then YOLO it again and see. Yeah. You know, I think that's how a lot of people are thinking these days because they're like, dude, I'm never going to make it. I think the younger generation's looking at the price of housing and then looking at their wages and then looking at their future cognitive prediction of where work is going. And they're like, I either YOLO that shit or I just don't make it. So fuck it. I'll try. And I can't do that. So
you're averse to even having a portion of your portfolio.
I mean, you seem like a little bit extra. Like you're like 95% cash.
I need to change that. So part of this inventory was to say I'm going to like take all the disparate accounts that I have all over the place because I've had a varied work history. I've got 401ks I've got to consolidate and roll over, and I've got various dingleberry cash accounts and shit that I need to sweep. You know?
Yeah, you just got to do the administrative work.
And then I've got – my wife has stuff too, and so we were just doing a mutual inventory of everything, and I'm like, all right. we're mostly cash. It's time for me to figure out some sort of allocation here. And I'm not, I don't want to actively trade anything. I'm not.
Are you actually cash or like treasuries?
A mix.
Okay.
But I mean, short-term treasuries, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I got to allocate. And so now I'm facing this question of how to allocate wealth. I like the idea of diversification, but then
I mean, the most conservative thing you can do is consolidate all that and then just put it into a money market mutual fund, right? And then you can get, I mean, thousands of dollars a year.
I mean, I'm assuming, Teen, you're when you say cash, you're still getting five on it or close.
Yeah, let's just say that I don't consider a bunch of short-term treasuries at 5% in, quote, allocation. Okay. That's more just earning, like cash management, right?
That's the default.
So you're earning interest on it.
Yeah. But I feel like that's suboptimal, don't you think? I mean, part of the problem is that that's not a risk-free thing anymore because I'm not sure that just holding cash is risk-free because there's inflation, even though you're going to get a
there's return inflation, that's above inflation. But also the fucking banks are collapsing, in case anyone didn't notice. It's kind of happening.
I think so you have inflation as one risk. Another and related risk is that cash rates come down, stocks go up 20%, and you missed it, right? Like in a way.
Yeah, I want a little bit of participation in that, right?
Right.
But like, the trick is to figure out how much, and then I think there's another thing of just like, what are the possibilities? I think, you know, Mike, you laid it out well in terms of real assets, a house, some collectible stores of value, physical things, cars or whatever. And then a mix of securities.
Yeah, and when I say crypto. House, like I've been in this condo for 6 years now, and I plan on being here for until I'm like too old to climb the stairs. So even though we have an elevator too, so it's like a lot of people think investing in real estate means you're like flipping houses or like buying additional houses or something, but no, like. You should probably just buy a place you want to stay in for 20 years, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I'm just talking about where is your net worth stored?
Yeah.
You know, exactly. I'm not talking about any active sort of side hustle or any of that shit, because I ain't got no side to hustle.
The one thing I will say is like okay, so one part of this is what are you going to put it in the actual asset allocation question, right? But probably like
what's available even? What's the universe of possibilities here?
I mean, it's reasonably broad, but like the other part of it is how are you going to psychologically manage the potential downside risk, right? Like if you suddenly take an example, 50% of your wealth and you put it into stocks and we get a 20% drawdown. Okay, well you've just wiped out 10% of your net worth. Are you going to feel terrible and it's going to like affect the way that you approach financial management, or it's going to affect the way that you approach investing going forward, right? Like try to understand. So I say, like, you got to understand your risk tolerance and almost do like this kind of regret minimization exercise, right? And slowly just feed it in. Don't like my initial thought would be, okay, well, you should probably slowly feed this in to the market over the course of like 2 years or something, right? Where you take
especially on the risk asset side, like
on the risk. If you just buy,
if you
like
want to hit like let's say 50% allocation to equities, I wouldn't do it today.
I would advocate for people to
slowly dip in, because 2024 is going to be a pretty wild year, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I will say like if you go through like pure theory, pure math of it, right? The answer probably is. You should just go tomorrow to 50%, right? And if you
don't think dollar cost averaging makes sense?
Dollar cost averaging, I mean,
it makes sense if you start it when you're 20, but not when you're 45, maybe.
No, but even over the course of a year, I mean, like
if you want to put
half of your net worth into stocks, do you think it's better to just buy it tomorrow, or do you? Over a year like this year, let's say a potentially very volatile year, it's not better to just do, you know, like a weekly or monthly allocation?
So the thing about dollar cost, like if you do the math and the modeling of it, right, for dollar cost averaging to work, out better requires like a pretty strong amount of reasonably predictable mean reversion in markets, right? Over a period of time that is compatible with the speed of your dollar cost averaging. Like there's a lot of conditions that require that, you know, that require it to work for you. Versus the, you know, if you just go to the sort of like 50% or 40% or whatever is quote unquote optimal for you, the only assumption there is that markets have some kind of random walk to them and a positive expected return, right? Which admittedly is still like a whole bunch of assumptions. The reason why I would say you should be dollar cost averaging, even though it is quote unquote suboptimal, is purely to manage your own psychology, right? That I didn't go all in suddenly or half in suddenly and screw it up. That's it.
The trick is if there's a massive pullback, you also have to be willing to buy
exactly.
on the way down or at the lows.
And it is hard. Right? I tell you, it is hard.
Because that's where a lot of your returns are going to come from when you buy at the lows and
buy the dip.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. Like to me, it, you want to buy a little bit over time. Like, I think that's just the prudent thing because that also just matches the way you make your money. Like you're obviously not paid in a lump sum. So you kind of have no choice but to do it over time since you're going to get paid over time. But I mean, I think, you know, stocks, I mean, like, let's just be honest, right? Like everyone is afraid of a 2000 Y2K scenario where the NASDAQ just gets cut by 80% and then doesn't recover for like a decade.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the nightmare scenario, right? And that can definitely happen. So it's pretty scary, which is why I don't just like put all my money in the stock market. Like some people do. Some people's IRA and 401k is nothing but stocks, which I don't really enjoy because I've seen two major downturns in my life. And to think that won't happen again before I'm 65 or whatever is crazy.
Like we've seen like probably just since 2008, right? If you think about 08 and COVID, those are like two once in a generation events or once in two generation events that happened within 12 years of each other.
Yeah.
12, 13 years of each other. Right. Like, it's kind of wild.
Yeah. So I think it's definitely going to happen again. Now the thing that I also hold Bitcoin, and I think if you can stomach the volatility, then, you know, I think everyone should, I mean, it's in the ETF form now, right? So it's
super easy.
Everyone should put a little bit of money into there. And
if it's 1% gold, too. Gold's been surging along.
Yeah, gold's done well this month.
I mean, any of these like alternative assets, I think you should put a little bit of money in. And it's
so everyone calls Bitcoin digital gold. And I'm like, why don't you just buy gold? Because gold has not made. It's not nearly as volatile as Bitcoin, and it hasn't made big moves on the upward.
So, you know, the theory behind this is that a lot of people are actually getting out of the gold ETFs, and so the theory is that China and India and to a certain extent Russia are actually keeping the gold price elevated because they keep buying this weakness and floating the price of gold as more people are getting out of the ETFs.
I am highly... China is the largest gold producer in the world.
What's the theory of people getting out of gold ETFs? Is there documented net outflows from
net
like,
outflows from GLD and all that stuff? Yeah.
But GLD is very retail, right? Like I think for gold, there's a huge market that's obviously just like official central banks, and they're not going to tell you, right?
Sure.
And there's like a huge jewelry market. I think like GLD, but to be fair, on a retail level for like US punters, it's going to be GLD against these Bitcoin ETFs. But gold is done very, very well this
year. Are people exiting gold ETFs because they want participation in Bitcoin?
Actually, I haven't checked. I
mean, that's people are speculating that, but also, there's got to be.
Sure of... Like how many people were like sitting on a ton of gold waiting for this Bitcoin thing to be, you know, like crazy gold people waiting for this Bitcoin ETF to be announced?
I think it's just gold hasn't done much for the last 10 years and people are just getting out of it because they're older. Like who
surging.
Is your typical gold holder? Like an older person.
But I like that. I like an asset that hasn't done much, but then there might be some potential.
Yeah. The max pain is that everyone gets out of GLD and then it fucking skyrockets.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yep. that could very well happen. Yeah.
What I don't want to do is buy into Bitcoin at $69,000.
You say this, but I will tell you I truly believe that 1 million for Bitcoin is entirely possible. Entirely possible.
What would the market cap, because there's 21 million. We're at 20 million Bitcoin, right?
Glad you asked. Yeah. Glad you asked. 21 okay, million.
So 20 million times 20, a million.
20, no, but 21 million. 30% lost coins is the estimate.
Okay, fine.
Right?
Whatever.
So that leaves you with 15. Okay. At a million per?
Times a million.
That's 15 trillion. What's the market cap of gold? Like what's the market cap of 10? Gold? Market cap of gold, it's 15 now. 14 and a half, 15.
Oh, okay.
So all I'm asking is it's gone up. Yeah. Yeah, I'm just saying, can Bitcoin
gold is the third largest gold is the third largest central bank reserve asset after US dollars and euros. So in order for that to happen, I think you would have to have Bitcoin as an official reserve asset of major.
I think
yes, major but I think that state, is I think that is absolutely bank. In the cards. I think that is absolutely
I think that's
in the
possible
cards.
And maybe even probable over the long run. And look, my framework for holding Bitcoin, and I have it in cold storage. I have a little bit of the ETF in my YOLO account, but my main Bitcoin holding is on cold storage. And I just don't like, what if, like, I've done all the research. I know all of the tech, you know, like the, to a reasonable extent, I'm not a developer of Bitcoin or anything, but, you know, I know all of the arguments in favor and against Bitcoin. Right. And if I just hold it because if this thing actually has legs and will slowly become some kind of, maybe not the standard, you know, reserve asset, but some kind of reserve asset or some kind of currency backed.
Some kind of stable, like it's going to reach, it has to reach a stability though.
It can't have these wild swings,
but like as the price goes up, it implies two things. One, much greater adoption. And with much greater adoption should come much lower vol, right? Gold, but gold, keep in mind, gold is also not involatile, right? It's probably got a vol.
Yeah, it goes
like
up and
maybe,
down for sure.
You know,
yeah, but it's, 13, dude, 15. Compare, I mean, it's pretty
compared
stable.
To Bitcoin.
You do not see, you know, 8% swings in gold
sure,
in a day.
Sure. Once every maybe like 5 years or something like that. But
yeah. Well, yeah, you see that starts. Every day in fucking Bitcoin.
Bitcoin
is the look. Here's the thing. Here's my argument against Bitcoin as a store of value. There's no store of value function to an asset that swings that much more than a meme stock. You could might as well say Nvidia stock is a store of value.
I mean, but that's the thing. It's not there. It's not a store of value yet.
Yeah, but that's the theory that people are assigning to its inherent values as a store of value.
Yeah, but why?
That's not incompatible.
My point of view on this is I don't even care about the debate. If this thing has any chance at all of becoming some kind of monetary standard in whatever form that may be, I
want
to own some.
You want a piece.
That's it, true. Period. Yep. That's it, period. I don't care about the day-to-day debate. Like, it just doesn't matter to me.
But people,
so I have X percent in Bitcoin, and I'm just going to sit on it forever.
Yeah.
But I don't need the money.
But the more you allocate, the more you should care.
Well, it's going up, so it's inherently the allocation is going up.
But
No. I'm saying as a mix of your you're in my position, the more of my wealth I want to allocate to Bitcoin, the more I should care.
This is going to sound really
culty, okay? So bear with me for a second.
Sure. I love this.
But let's say the more you have allocated to Bitcoin, the more confidence and conviction you will have in its value in the future.
Well, yeah, you're going to be a Bitcoin partisan.
You saying self-fulfilling?
That's the thing. I have this. This is true of any asset. And if it's true of anything you buy, you become sort of defensive over the choices you make. You know, like people will buy. I know people who will buy their cars, and despite it being a shitty car, they just to avoid the reality of them having made a bad decision or whatever.
People are always defending
what they buy.
Yeah, but I mean but you can't extrapolate that nobody will ever sell anything they buy. Like that, and people change their minds all the time, right? Like I've bought stuff that I've sold a week later. because I was like, oh, this is a shitty decision. that was dumb. Why did I do that?
That's the point of capitulation, where you buy a lot of Bitcoin, you get into the culty aspect of it, and then you're like, whoa, shit, it just swung down. I'm not a toddler, I'm out. You know?
But that's the thing. Like you have to understand when you're reacting based on rationality versus emotion.
I don't think there's any rational case for.
I held through the downturn from the previous 69K to what was it 16, 15, or 16.
Yeah, same.
I just sat there like what, you know.
You know the problem now is because if you have stuff in cold storage or whatever. You know, it's kind of a pain in the ass to move that stuff.
It is, yeah. That's part of the wire.
But now that we have ETF instruments, I feel like that might even exacerbate some of the volatility because it's just become so much easier to trade.
Liquid. It's liquid now.
Yeah, and you're outsourcing all the pain in the ass trading to like ETF desks.
Now, but okay, so the counter argument to that is the people who buy the ETF are either traders who would trade it in and out all day, anyways. Or they're older people who only put a fraction of their net, like a tiny fraction of their net worth into it, and they just don't care.
I mean, I think like, look, I've moved almost all of mine from the old days to ETF. Candace had ETF for a little while longer, to be fair, right? Just out of, especially now that I'm kind of out of the taxation regime, right? It's easier. It's just easier. Like I don't have to deal with the. That is a legitimate weakness of Bitcoin, right? Like dealing with the keys, dealing with cold storage is a pain in the ass. Pain in the ass, right? And I thought it was like, look, if I croak, I don't know if my wife knows how to deal with the keys, and then you're just looking at like, you know, a big chunk of lost Bitcoins, effectively.
Lost Bitcoins, yeah.
Right.
I'm not saying ETF is
just like ETF is effectively it's a regulated thing. You can just go in there and be like, yeah, click sell, right? So.
Whatever form you choose to get exposure to Bitcoin, I think everyone should have a little bit just because they either think it's a complete fucking scam and they're smarter than that. So they just don't touch it, which is like, okay, how many more years does it have to exist and go?
Yeah.
Up
see, like I on that one, I think I have spent enough time interrogating this and I have debated with enough people in the industry that I'm pretty confident of the view here, at least to the point where I think 1 million per is entirely reasonable and we're at 70, we're at sub 70, we're at 66 or something like that, right? Do I believe this enough to be long at 66 when the target's a million? Absolutely. Absolutely. If we look at 250, at 300, 500K, am I going to have like a first class problem to deal with? Yeah. I'll deal with it then. Just going back to the earlier point about psychological management though, I think part of the ability to hold through that, you know, multiple 80% drawdowns at this point is because my cost base on this is low, right? It's like my cost base is not like 65K, right? Like it's like way south of that. And if, you know, if I were looking at this today and not having a position and thinking, do I get in? I would be very hesitant to be like, oh yeah, let me just take, you know, I guess if you put in like 0.5% of your net worth, it's kind of like, okay, whatever, right? But I'm not going to go and put like 5% of my net worth or something in it today at these prices, right? You're going to slowly feed it in.
I mean, yeah, just buy like a few thousand bucks. And then if you feel comfortable with it, do more later. You know, I just don't understand the people who absolutely
go with zero. Yeah. It's like, isn't the potential
there? I absolutely
there?
Refuse to do this. It's like, okay, why? Why do you, like, who are you, who are you? Like, what are you trying to prove?
Okay. Hold on. Here's the thing about Bitcoiners. Why? Okay. If I said I don't want to touch Nvidia stock, if I say I don't want to touch AI stocks, if I don't, you know, whatever, where's that little, what is that? Why is there like this thumbs up bubble?
No,
coming out of,
I don't think, like, for me,
do you see
it's
that?
Not that.
Yeah,
it's not
no,
that.
No, 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 no. Wait, hold on. Here's my thing. There's no other asset right now that people, like, for example, if I say I don't want to touch gold because I don't believe that there's a future, no gold bug comes out and starts yelling at me
like that. No, yeah,
dude, you haven't, yeah, you haven't met gold bugs, man. Some of these people are crazy.
Okay, like, what I'm saying is people don't give a shit. If I don't want to hold NVIDIA stock, nobody gives a shit. If I don't want to hold Berkshire S&P 500, if I don't want to hold...
But ask a question in reverse.
Hold on. When it comes to Bitcoin,
you get
passionate people who start getting angry at you for not wanting to hold it. It's really weird.
Well, if you say that you don't want to hold the S&P 500, there's an entire army of people called Bogleheads that will tell you you're a fucking moron and that you should
dollar cost average and despise for the rest of your life. Well, here's the thing. In my experience, I don't have a problem with Bogleheads. I don't have a problem with gold bugs. But I do have a problem with people who are constantly spewing Bitcoin prophecies.
Yeah, but so what?
Prophecies.
Just ignore them.
But they won't. They will chase you down.
Now you're
positioning this investment opportunity as you versus these crazy people.
No, I'm not. No, yeah. I'm just a person. I'm not anti-Bitcoin.
I hate these people. So it's just
it's not that I hate these people. The problem I have with Bitcoin is that there is, to me, like, you're really not allowed to form your own thoughts about it. Either you join the cult of Bitcoin or you're full of shit. And I just see it as like another potential. It's one asset out of loads of assets.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It is one out of
name of. Don't tell me that there isn't some weird special cult of fucking something around it.
Yeah, it's very cult.
Because people are extremely passionate about it.
I think that
there's a lot of younger people who have elevated Bitcoin to be a YOLO asset where they're kind of hoping against hope, I think, that there is this inversion out in the world where fiat currencies become worthless and the class structure and the power structure of the entire world inverts so that Bitcoin holders become the elite.
I think the fiat owners get pushed to the bottom.
And that's a really weird idea.
It's not weird at all. So I think the first time we talked about this, I made the analogy between Bitcoin and the open source software.
First of all, it is a weird idea. I'm not saying it's not true, but it is a weird idea. It's never happened before. Well, there's never been a non-state currency that became the world's reserve asset. So it is strange.
To me, this is just my interpretation.
Don't bring up the gold thing. It's not going to...
Come on, man.
So, to me, all of this stuff is perfectly analogous. Not perfectly, but very. It's a close analogy to the topic, right?
It's not normal.
It is new and weird. Back in the 90s when Linux was a terrible operating system and it didn't underpin the entire internet and Android and everything, open source software zealots were looked at like they had three heads. Like, what do you mean people will work on software for free? Like, what is that communism? Like, this is communism. And then there would be like commercial Unix and Windows and like NT or whatever zealots who would just laugh their heads off at this stupid technology, this hippy dippy shit that has never been done before, that would obviously go nowhere. So you're wasting your time in your career by even looking into this, let alone specializing in it. And lo and behold, 30 years later, it basically runs the entire internet. And like, it's the most widely used operating system. And everyone who knows it has done very, very well in their careers. So it's, things can change.
Yeah, but what does that have to do with Bitcoin? Bitcoin is literally a piece of open source software
that just runs on computers.
Yeah, but it was just the carbon copy of Unix to some extent, right? I mean, it's just a different legal and development model, or not even really. I mean, Unix was already kind of distributed before that.
The point is everyone thought it was crazy and stupid.
Yeah, but and everything's like, I mean, if that's the analogy,
yeah, everything is like that.
No, but I'm saying anything could be analogized to Linux. Sure, like, people didn't believe in it.
Okay,
but then you're just saying you kind of have to assess the case on its merits, right?
I mean, I think people are clear-eyed that
there is a cult around Bitcoin.
There's a bunch of zealots.
Yes, there's a bunch of zealots
that make it look bad.
There is a bunch of zealots.
And people get turned off by that.
part of that is because...
who gets blamed for that? People who are skeptical. People get who are skeptical get yelled at about that.
But people, okay, so there is
part failing of that to see
is
the
same with
Bitcoin
Linux,
itself
same with open source software in general.
Oh, come on.
Bitcoin itself is inherently political, but at the same time, the anti-Bitcoin crowd is, I would say, considerably louder and considerably more vocal. Not blaming them necessarily, not saying like, oh, one side is wrong, one other side is wrong, whatever.
Who's the anti-Bitcoin?
Oh, you are.
No, I'm not. I'm just skeptical. That doesn't mean I'm anti-Bitcoin.
No, I think it feels like it feels like you're anti. It feels like you're anti.
That's my point. I'm not anti-Bitcoin. People are it's so fucking weird. If I haven't, if I don't buy into Bitcoin as the future of international money, I'm anti-Bitcoin.
No, I don't. It's
not that you don't. It's
anti-Bitcoin means I think it should be
the argument.
Anti-Bitcoin to me means I think it should be made illegal.
Okay, but then
I think that it should be banished.
By that same vein,
I don't say that.
By that same vein, am I pro-Bitcoin?
You?
Yeah.
I have no idea. I don't know what your attitude towards Bitcoin is. I'm absolutely not anti-Bitcoin. I just think that people should have a realistic view of it and not approach it as, are you a believer or not a believer? Am I a believer in any asset that I invest in? I mean...
Yeah, but would you even trade it?
Bitcoin?
Yeah, assuming you are a trader, which you're not, I gather.
What do you mean, would I trade? You mean for like short-term day trading it?
Yeah, just like
trading. Yeah, of course.
Swing trade it, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, there's more action in that than anything else, isn't there? I mean, it's a very attractive trading asset, I would think, especially now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good enough reason to buy
some. People do
that. Yeah, but that doesn't require any belief whatsoever.
No, that just
doesn't require belief at all.
Yeah.
Like, you can just do technical analysis and trade the thing, right?
Yeah, so I'm not anti-Bitcoin. I just find...
Okay,
my point is that...
Like, yeah, I agree with you, there are evangelists, but at the same time, there are counter-evangelists, let's say. It is a very heated topic. Much more so than, hey, do you believe in the S&P 500?
I think there's very few counter-evangelists at this point. I think that the mainstream has largely adopted Bitcoin as a legitimate asset.
I don't think we're there yet.
What are you talking about? Bitcoin prices... Bitcoin prices published right on the ticker. You know, if you go to Wall Street Journal or whatever, Bloomberg, Bitcoin prices right there next to the major indices. So I think you're wrong.
Well, yeah, there's an ETF.
I mean,
now,
so. Sure. It's like a hot topic right now. But I think like the road, like if it becomes a real thing,
it will crash again and it will fall out of favor, rise again and then it will come into favor and it will just repeat over and over and over.
All right, here we go. Like, we're at an hour. Can we draw a line here and say we're gonna continue talking about Bitcoin for a bit as a bonus?
Sure.
Let's do it.
This is the end of part one of a two-part podcast. If you want access to part two, it'll be on our Patreon feed. If you're not already a supporter, go to patreon.com/planningmag.